was a castle and I am the sentry, granting the spineless the easiest entry. My simple subjects are eager to bow, so fire up the spit, wheel in the cow. I'm in my element now. I'm toasting my virtue, the goblet is passed. 54 jesters are kissing my ass. I may be fat, but my belt has to bust before this binging can end. I'm feeding my ego again. Whisper their praises, they're nursing me now with their sweet empty phrases. The critics are cleaved from my peace with the mallet. No spoils are received by the king's fragile palate. Stuffing myself on the blind adulation, fed full of self, it's intense mastication. The simpleton's choir has taken its place, accolades spewing from each vacant face. Now let's say grace. Toasting my virtue, the goblet is passed. 54 jesters are kissing my ass. I may be fat, but my belt has to bust before this binging can end. Feeding my ego again. The goblet is passed. 54 jesters are kissing my ass. I may be fat, but my belt has to bust before this binging can end. Feeding my ego, toasting my virtue. The goblet is passed. 54 jesters are kissing my ass. I may be fat, but my belt has to bust before this binging can end.
That is my man, Stuart Davis, whom I discovered when I was living in Minnesota. Finally got around to visiting him here in Santa Cruz last September. Okay, this is the Mideast Madness Show. My name is Ren Tawil. And for the uninitiated, I am an Arab American. My father was born and raised in Jerusalem. Jerusalem and its environs. So that makes me a Palestinian American specifically. My father was very fortunate in that he was here in America, the United States, in May of 1948, and so missed the action, which may very well have taken his life had he been there, just that it has taken his brother and business partner's life, who was killed by Zionist partisans. Now, that's all I'm going to give you right now of my personal horror stories regarding this matter. But Mideast Madness does address the Israel-Palestine and Israel-Arab debacle, as it says on my business card. I try to avoid using the word truth, the truth, or true, when doing this show, because I do not want this show to be just another, forum for propaganda for one side or the other on this matter. Instead, I want people to call in and be a part of this dialogue. Call into the show. We're on until 4:55. You may interrupt anything that I'm doing, even music. And let's discuss this. I've met a number of Jewish people over the last few months just on the street, just engaging them casually on Pacific Avenue. I have invited various Jewish congregations, temples, synagogues, to listen to my show. I've invited the Islamic Center to listen to my show. I have no way of knowing at this point if any of those have been takers and conceded to listening. But this show is for you as much as it is for me, as much as it is for anyone. We here in the United States need to talk about the Middle East situation. And being a Palestinian American, I am not hiding the fact that although I promise to be civil and respectful and ask that any callers into the show do the same, without question, there is a pro-Palestinian / pro-Arabic bias. That's where I'm coming from, and that's why this show is the way that it is. Let me give you the phone numbers. Direct to the studio, and we are live this Monday, March the 11th, 2013. It's 10 after 3 o'clock. Area code 831-427-3772. 427-3772. If that's busy, there is a line too, 469-3119. 469-3119. And before we get to the meat of the program, let me do the typical and expected of me request for donations. We do not get corporate funds. I, as a programmer, and all the other programmers pay our dues. We do not get paid to do this on pirate radio. We pay for the privilege of doing the show. The rest is really made up by you. And donations have come in, several hundred dollars, according to our last collective meeting in February. So please keep it coming. If you value this service, if you value and treasure my show and my lovely voice, please send your donations to Free Radio Santa Cruz or simply FRSC, Post Office Box 7811, Santa Cruz, C-R-U-Z, California, zip code 95061. Of course, technically the O is a zero because we're speaking in numeric terms. Okay. I need to pull up my personal website again because I remembered almost till the last minute that I needed to reboot the computer for safety and security. As many of you know, Barack Obama will be shortly on his way, if not there already, to Israel, perhaps to other places in the Middle East. I believe will be visiting, Jordan, most likely Egypt, and who knows where else in the Middle East. And back to back, I've received two messages. I shall read them. The first one is from the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, subtitled Over Three Decades of Advocacy and Achievement. Let's see, dated March 11, that's today, Monday. President Obama meets with Arab American leaders ahead of Middle East trip. So I guess he may have left, or he may not have quite have left, because the dispatch is dated today, March 11th. President Obama meets with Arab American leaders ahead of Middle East trip. Just now, President Obama met with Arab American community leaders in advance of his trip to the Middle East. We are pleased to have shared with President Obama our recommendations and, whoopsie, there we go, it's better. We are pleased to have shared with President Obama our recommendations and vital messages that he should convey to the Palestinian people. Today's meeting was an important opportunity for Arab Americans to share our views and continue to serve as a bridge between the U.S. and the Arab world. Our meeting underscored the president's recognition of the importance of our community's contributions to discussions of policy in the region. The United States, through sustained, balanced, constructive engagement, can facilitate a peaceful, lasting resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, a resolution that is essential to long-term security in the Middle East. We thank President Obama for engaging Arab American leaders in this critical dialogue, and we look forward to using this meeting as a springboard for robust, ongoing conversations on U.S. policy in the Middle East. Message signed by American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, the ADC, the American Task Force for Palestine, the American Federation of Ramallah, Palestine, and the Arab American Institute. And that is the short message from the ADC. Interestingly enough, as I said, there were two messages back to back. You've heard one from the Arab persuasion, and now the Arizona Jewish Post has an article. Let me pull that up here for you. Dated today, Monday, March 11th. The Arizona Jewish Post. Obama to Jews. Peace is essential, but prospects are bleak. This is dated March 8th. That was last Friday. By Ron Compies, JTE. There's a picture here of President Barack Obama talking with Chief of Staff Jack Lew and Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner as they were on the colonnade of the White House. Shortly before the president announced Lew is his nominee to replace Geithner as Treasury Secretary January 10th. Okay, that's irrelevant. Here's the article. Obama to Jews, peace is essential, but prospects are bleak. Washington, JTA. President Obama believes prospects for Israeli-Palestinian peace are, quote, bleak. But he still will urge both sides to avoid unilateral actions that might further damage a process he hopes will be back on track within a year. As though we all haven't waited long enough. As though we all haven't waited so many years. Well over half a century for this debacle to be resolved. Continuing. That was the message Obama delivered Thursday in a meeting with about 25 Jewish community figures at the White House to discuss his planned trip to Israel after this month. So I guess that'll be April. April. I'm sorry. No, figure. to discuss his planned trip to Israel later this month, so shortly, before April. Obama was especially engaged, participants said, when it came to discussing how he might best convey to the Israeli people his enthusiasm for Israel and its Jewish history. Very engaged. Participants were under strict instructions to speak to news media only in the most general terms, and most of the participants contacted by JTA yielded to that stricture. Two participants, however, shared notes on the particulars, and a third confirmed those accounts. I take it those strict instructions were given by the White House. By our government. According to the participants, Obama appeared weary and was emphatic about not bringing any, quote, grandiose plan for Middle East peace to the region. He said he would, however, counsel the parties against making, quote, unilateral moves. He did not elaborate, but U.S. references to unilateralism generally refer to Israeli settlement activity in the West Bank and Palestinian attempts to achieve statehood recognition. Obama reportedly rejected an entreaty from one participant to stake out a harder line on Israel's suspected, a harder line on Iran's suspected nuclear weapons program, emphasizing that a military option was still on the table, even though he preferred to first exhaust diplomatic options. Officials from the major powers, led by the United States, are meeting with Iran in Istanbul later this month to negotiate terms for making Iran's nuclear program more transparent. Obama said he would not engage in, quote, chest beating to make people feel better. He also said it's natural for the United States and Israel to have differing assessments of how advanced Iran is in its nuclear quest. Such differences are a matter of interpretation, the president said, and exist within Israel's political and security establishments as well. Again, people, this I'm reading from an article in today's Arizona Jewish Post, written by Ron Kempeas of the JTA. When he goes to Israel, Obama plans to meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is still attempting to cobble together a government after January's election. In Israel, Obama also will meet with Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas and will travel to Jordan to meet with King Abdullah. Obama told the Jewish participants that he thinks prospects for peace are, quote, bleak, but added, that doesn't mean 6 or 9 or 12 months from now we won't be in the midst of a policy initiative, end quote. Obama said he would tell the Israelis that, quote, the prospects for peace continued to go through the Palestinians, end quote. A White House official confirmed that the president would not be seeking a specific outcome from this visit. The president noted that the trip is not dedicated to resolving a specific policy issue, but is rather an opportunity to consult with the Israeli government about a broad range of issues, including Iran, Syria, the situation in the region, and the peace process, the White House official said. He continues, he also underscored that the trip is an opportunity for him to speak directly to the Israeli people about the history, interests, and values that we share. Obama seemed more enthusiastically engaged, participants said, when he was seeking input from them on how to best reach out to Israelis and make them feel secure about the U.S.-Israel alliance. The exchange took up the bulk of the meeting, with Obama fielding more than a dozen questions and suggestions over 45 minutes. Nathan Diament, the Washington director of the Orthodox Union, said that he counseled the president to emphasize the Jewish connection to the land. Quote, I underscored the need for him to go to a place where he can both symbolically and in his statement speak about the millennia of connections between the Jewish people and Israel, said Diament, or perhaps Diament, or Diamant, who spoke under conditions that allowed participants to relay their own words to reporters. Israeli and U.S. officials for weeks have grappled with which venues would best convey Obama's outreach effort. One factor is security. Israeli officials have told their American counterparts that securing Obama outside the Jerusalem-Tel Aviv corridor is daunting, which limits his options. Aside from the official meetings with Israeli and Palestinian leaders, a visit to the Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial in Jerusalem and dinner at the home of President Shimon Peres, Netanyahu is the prime minister, Peres is the Israeli president, who will present Obama with a medal, nothing has been confirmed. In other words, aside from those facts, nothing else has been confirmed. A visit to Jerusalem's old city is still under consideration, as is a tour of an Iran dome missile defense battery, a system Obama funded and which successfully protected Israel from rocket attacks during the Gaza Strip war last November. Obama wants to speak to, quote, young people, White House officials have said, and Israeli officials reportedly are working on a venue that would accommodate a large crowd of university students, probably in Jerusalem. In a separate interview with JTA, and I'm sorry it escapes me for the moment what JTA stands for, Jewish something or other, I'm sure, Michael Lauren, Israel's ambassador to Washington, said Israelis are looking forward to the visit because of the message it will send. Quote, in terms of Israel, the timing of the trip could not be better because it reassures us in a period of profound instability throughout the region and sends an unequivocal message throughout the region about the strength and vitality of the U.S.-Israel alliance, Oren said. In addition to the Orthodox Union, participants at the meeting included representatives of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, the Jewish Federations of North America, the Jewish Council for Public Affairs, J Street, Americans for Peace Now, the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, B'nai B'rith International, the Conservative and Reform Movements of the Jewish Faith, the Anti-Defamation League, slightly misspelled there, the American Jewish Committee, Hadassah, the National Council of Jewish Women, Jewish Women International, the National Jewish Democratic Council, the World Jewish Congress, and the Simon Wiesenthal Center. Influential supporters of the president also were in attendance, including Robert Wexler, Mel Levine, Steve Rabinowitz, and Alan Dershowitz. Okay, that is the article from the Arizona Jewish Post. Now the part you've all been waiting for. My commentary on what I just read. Let me remind you, the phones are open to the studio, live to the studio, area code 831-427-3772. Line 2 is 469-3119. Okay, overall, there's a lot of vagueness that is displayed in this article. Nobody wants to say too much of anything. Well, if, centering on President Obama, of course, he doesn't want to commit to specific policy targets. Everyone here is so cautious. Like what it said about Obama appeared weary and was emphatic about not bringing any grandiose plans for Middle East peace to the region. He counseled the parties against making unilateral moves. Didn't want to engage in chest beating to make people feel better. Well, I think those are, generally speaking, wise statements for him to make. They're certainly cautionary. But I think Obama's caution has a lot to do with the fact that he has already gained a reputation as the first president, possibly in the history of the modern state of Israel, to attempt to hold Israel's feet to the fire when it comes to proceeding with the Palestinians in a genuine dialogue for peace and for making some real progress. In other words, Obama has gained this reputation being the first president in a long time, in my opinion, to dare to confront Israel and challenge their sincerity on proceeding with peace on an equal level with the Palestinian people. He came from attack from all the Jewish quarters in the United States, as well as from Israel, as they put it, throwing Israel under the bus. Simply because he brings up things that for the longest time no one wanted to bring up, because almost everyone knows the potential consequences of being tagged as an anti-Semitic authority. For the most part, I like President Obama. I sure like him as a personality, as a real person. But alas, despite his being a Democrat, despite his leftist leanings, he is contained in the American presidency by the same factors that have contained all of the recent presidents in the last 50, 60, 70 years. Namely, people telling him all the things that he can't do, even though he is, as Abraham Lincoln put it, cloaked in immense power. According to the movie I saw about Lincoln. Let's see. Now, Obama delivers a message, as it says here, in a meeting with about 25 Jewish community figures at the White House to discuss his planned trip to Israel. That's 25 individuals, human beings, and much later in the article, I'm going to go right to that. This long, not-so-short paragraph ticks off all these organizations. The Orthodox Union, Jewish Federations of North America, the Jewish Council for Public Affairs, J Street, Americans for Peace Now, blah, 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 Hadassah, National Council of Jewish Women, Jewish Women International. The entire paragraph does not contain one reference to his meeting with any Arabs. Of course, this is a Jewish periodical that I'm reading from, but as you know, ADC proudly, if humbly at the same time, thanked President Obama for meeting with them. Now, ADC is the leading Arab-American political organization here in the United States, and they have announced just today or yesterday, today, that Obama met with them. We are not finding that reference in this article of the Arizona Jewish Post. And I will admit to you, chances are small that the president met with any other organizations or even individuals who represent or stand with the Palestinians for the sake of this presidential visit across the sea. To me, that says his meeting with the ADC was nothing more than an opportunity for the Arab Americans to converse with him. And they probably had to scratch and claw in order to obtain and attain that visit with President Obama. A week or two ago, I ticked off in another article I was reading to you the names of all these American Jewish for Israel organizations, including several that I named here in this article, talking about the influence, the enormous, even almost outlandish influence that the Jewish faith, that the Zionists, and that the nation of Israel has in Washington, and the abilities of AIPAC and others to lobby the legislature and the president. AIPAC, American Israel Public Affairs Committee, which in effect is the American Israel Political Action Committee, AIPAC, is next to the NRA, the National Rifle Association, one of the two of those is the most powerful and the most intimidating of all the political lobbies in Washington, D.C. Anyway, that was material from a previous show. Of course, it talks here about, let's see. Obama seemed more enthusiastically engaged, participants said, when he was seeking input from them on how best to reach out to Israelis and make them feel secure about the U.S.-Israel alliance. The U.S.-Israel alliance, in reality, is not a general term, such as one might say the U.S.-Romanian alliance, simply because Romania is a friend of the United States, as is Canada, as is Japan, to some degree as China and Russia are now. It's not just a general designation. The U.S.-Israel alliance has a nickname. It's often referred to as the special connection or the special arrangement, special alliance. Something special about it. Really a nebulous term, which probably has no place in the law. That alone is a feel-good kind of label to assure American Jews and American Jewish organizations, pro-Zionist, pro-Israel organizations, that U.S. will not throw Israel under the bus. That's one indication of the power of the Israel lobby. Now, phones are open, folks, at 3:37 here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 FM, streaming live at freakradio.org. Let's hear some phone calls. I will welcome any criticisms you have of what I'm saying, any corrections to what I'm saying. Uh, you know, in particular, when I use the word Jew or Jewish or Jewish influence, it is, I consider it absolutely vital that no one out there interprets this as anti-Semitism. Because, first of all, a lot of people automatically and without question are going to do that. They're going to take it for granted that a show like this, Mideast Madness, on free radio, on underground radio, pirate radio, is inherently anti-Semitic. And a lot of those people don't even bother to make a distinction between real instances of anti-Semitic behavior or anti-Semitic talk, and between that and anti-Zionism, the most sincere examples of which, anti-Zionism, are attempting to criticize Israeli policy, Israeli governmental policy, Zionist philosophy, and their military for things that are inexcusable and often get away with impunity. A lot of people, in my opinion, American Jews in particular, and many supporters of Israel in general, Jew and non-Jew, take for granted is automatically anti-Semitism. That's the purpose of it. The argument I have, the object of much of my criticism, is not the Jewish faith, is not any Jew, not any individual Jew in particular, no Jewish congregation. And I do not intend to criticize Judaic history, although I have been known to read to you a number of articles, most of them by Jews, authored by Jews themselves, which refute the claims of many Zionists about the authenticity and genuineness of their claim to Eretz Israel, to the land of Israel. But again, those are other shows. Continuing with my commentary on the Arizona Jewish Post article. Yeah. When he goes to Israel, Obama plans to meet with Benjamin Netanyahu, who's still putting his government together after the election 2 months ago. He'll also meet with Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, who is in charge in the West Bank, and will travel to Jordan to meet with King Abdullah. Now, traveling to meet with the king of another country outside of Israel carries a lot of weight, as our political leaders see it, because Jordan is a sovereign country, which was established before Israel was. I should point out that it was established with the eventual approval of the colonizing imperial powers of Great Britain and France. Anyway, I'm saying it's one thing for our president to meet with the leader of Jordan, an accepted sovereign independent country, and another thing for him to meet with the PA President Mahmoud Abbas. That is also probably little more than a token acknowledgement of his existence and the Palestinian people's existence. And from what I read a while back, Obama will not be spending more than an hour or so with President Abbas. Tokenism. Once again, in order to make the trip appear to be a balanced visit with a number of authorities, he's going to spend a minimum amount of time, like 1 hour, with Mahmoud Abbas after he goes into private and not-so-private meetings with the Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel, goes for the proverbially expected visit to the Holocaust, the Holocaust Memorial, speaks to school kids, and will have many, many opportunities to connect with the Israeli people. I only wonder if he will be speaking to any Palestinian children. I underscored the need for him to go to a place where he can both symbolically and in his statements speak about the millennia of connection between the Jewish people and Israel, said Diamant, who spoke under conditions that allowed participants to relay their own words to reporters. Of course, this is something the Israelis are hungry for. Continued, incessant promotion of what they consider to be the legitimacy of the Jewish race and the Jewish faith to the land of Palestine. I'm not denying that there's a connection there. There is a great deal of connectiveness that Jews have with the Holy Land, just as there is a great deal of connectiveness that Christians and Muslims and people of other faiths have to Jerusalem and that part of the world. It is for him to symbolically and in his statement speak about millennia of connection about the Jewish people in Israel is, well, frankly, in my opinion, a form of ass-kissing. In order for Obama to be perceived as legitimate, as a legitimate friend of Israel, he has to verbally confirm, in effect, that the rights of the Jewish people to their ancient historical homeland are more important than the rights of indigenous Arab Palestinians who were there now and have been for hundreds of years. Unbalanced rights. Okay, I'm getting tired of reading this particular post, and I shall return to another article here. The Hill is America's sentimental reference to the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., where our Congress sits, both the House of Representatives and the Senate. The Hill. And they publish a newsletter entitled The Hill. Specifically, this is from The Hill's Congress blog, where lawmakers come to blog. Now, that's important. Keep that in mind. This claims to be where lawmakers come to blog. So it is the some lawmaker somewhere who has permitted this to be written. It is entitled, quote, Israel Lobby, end quote, to push for aid despite sequestration cuts. This was actually written by Josh Rubner, who is the author of Why Obama Failed to Broker Israeli-Palestinian Peace. I take it that's a book. It could just be a long article. March 4th of this month, of this year. That's a week ago. That would be last Monday. Listen up. The long-dreaded sequestration has arrived, bringing with it potentially catastrophic consequences for governmental programs designed to benefit those most in need. The NAACP, that's the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, estimates these across-the-board cuts will result in 100,000 fewer low-income children being prepared for school through Head Start, 17 million fewer Meals on Wheels delivered to seniors suffering from food insecurity, and 1.6 million fewer unemployed Americans served through job training, education, and employment services. Yet as thousands of, quote, Israel first, end quote, citizen lobbyists descend on Capitol Hill tomorrow as part of the annual policy conference of the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, and this would have been last weekend, folks. The largest and most influential of the many groups comprising the, quote, Israel lobby, concern for these millions of Americans will not be on its legislative agenda. Instead, APAC will be lobbying to avert the impact of sequestration on record-breaking levels of United States military aid to Israel. It will also be pushing for legislation to boost the U.S.-Israel strategic alliance, quote-unquote, strategic alliance, and greenlight an Israeli attack on Iran, measures which will both inevitably entail demands for additional U.S. taxpayer-funded weapons to Israel. Israel stands to lose approximately $250 million of its $3.1 billion military aid package from the United States under the terms of the sequestration. The Jewish Week publication calls APAC's gambit to exempt these cuts a, quote, very risky strategy at a time when millions of Americans will be feeling the bite of the sequestration debacle, end quote, which, quote, could easily backfire and damage Israel far more than any cuts in its very generous grant aid program, end quote. Mind you, this was an there are quotes taken from a Jewish, American Jewish periodical, The Jewish Week. So some Jews are not only sensitive to this reality, they are courageous enough to warn Israel, and specifically APAC, the U.S.-Israel lobby in Washington, to warn them that this might not be a good idea. Good for those people. Again, I'm reading from The Hill's Congress blog, Israel Lobby to Push for Aid Despite Sequestration Cuts, by Josh Rubner. Indeed, why should APAC seek to, quote, single out Israel and, quote, hold it to a different standard? Unfounded charges, ironically enough, leveled by the Israel lobby at those who seek to hold Israel accountable to universal standards of human rights and international law. Why should APAC seek to single out Israel and hold it to a different standard by lobbying for greater levels of U.S. taxpayer aid for Israel at this time? After all, Israel is a wealthy country. According to the International Monetary Fund, Israel ranked 27th in per capita gross domestic product in 2011. 27th in per capita gross domestic product in the year 2011, with its residents enjoying a higher average income than people in Spain, South Korea, and Saudi Arabia. It could certainly afford to pay for those U.S. weapons it wanted without relying on the largesse of the American taxpayer. But instead, APAC demands that the United States underwrite approximately 20% of the Israeli military budget. Beyond the fiscal absurdity of this policy, what makes it even more galling is that U.S. taxpayers are thereby made complicit in Israel's systematic violation of Palestinian human rights, its military occupation, and, according to international law, I added that, illegal colonization of Palestinian land and its apartheid policies toward Palestinians, which deny them freedom and self-determination. You can call me anytime, folks. Don't be afraid to interrupt. Area code 831-427-3772 or 469-3119. Calls go directly to me in the studio. Back to the article. This military aid continues to flow despite the fact that United States laws such as the Arms Export Control Act and Foreign Assistance Act are designed to prevent foreign countries from misusing USA to commit human rights abuses. This tangible support for Israel's oppression of the Palestinians guts the credibility of U.S. claims to promote human rights and makes it exponentially more difficult for the United States to gain the trust of people around the world whose support is needed to confront the scourge of terrorism. Even Israeli military officials admit that U.S. military aid to Israel undermines broader U.S. interests. Is this, this is the Israeli military talking now. In a revealing cable from the U.S. Embassy in Tel Aviv, made public by WikiLeaks, Amos Gilad, head of the Political Military Bureau of the Israeli Ministry of Defense, and I quote here, acknowledged the sometimes difficult position the U.S. finds itself in given its global interests, and conceded that Israel's security focus is so narrow that its QME, that's Qualitative Military Edge, a provision written into U.S. law mandating weapons deliveries to Israel to maintain its dominance over any combination of potential enemies, concerns often clash with broader American security interests in the region, end quote. That's fascinating. I'm going to read it again. In a revealing cable from the United States Embassy in Tel Aviv, Israel, Tel Aviv being the capital of Israel that the United States still legally recognizes, the cable made public by WikiLeaks, that's Julian Assange's organization, WikiLeaks, Amos Gilad, head of the Political Military Bureau of the Israeli Defense, Ministry of Defense, quote, long, complicated sentence, listen closely, and I quote, acknowledge the sometimes difficult position the United States finds itself in given its global interests, and conceded that Israel's security focus is so narrow that its qualitative military edge, a provision written into U.S. law mandating weapons deliveries to Israel to maintain its dominance over any combination of potential enemies, Israel's security focus is so narrow that its QME concerns often clash with broader American security interests in the region. In other words, a major leader in a division of the IDF, the Israeli so-called defense forces, acknowledge that the taxpayer-funded U.S. military aid to Israel jeopardizes its other global interests, and that Israel's politically selfish focus is so narrow that concerns often clash with broader American security interests in the region. He is not an American, this Amos Gilad, and he acknowledges the contradictions here. As far as I know, Amos Gilad is not an American. I tend to assume he is an Israeli citizen, being a head of a political hyphen military bureau, is an Israeli citizen in good standing. He may also be a citizen of another country, most likely the United States, as the U.S. allows for dual citizenship, particularly between the U.S. and Israel. What I find eye-opening is this qualitative military edge, as it says here, a provision written into United States law mandating weapons deliveries to Israel to maintain its dominance over any combination of potential enemies. It's written into our law that this exclusive arrangement with another country takes precedence over whatever else. Even in 1948, the armed Zionist partisans, who later founded the State of Israel, actually outnumbered the combined armed forces, the combined armies of Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, and Egypt. The Israeli partisans outnumbered and by far had superior weapons to those Arab nations. That's how they were able to establish Israel at the expense of the native Palestinians. And they did so to a great degree without the help of U.S. military foreign aid. That was in 48. And in 56, Israel had the, at the time, oh-so-secret assistance of France and Britain in invading Egypt, the Sinai Peninsula. In 67, Israel launched its surprise attack, which they had planned for some 9.5 years and rehearsed and drilled for. Their IDF and their Air Force did. Surprise attack against the remaining portions of historical Palestine. That gave them the edge, making a surprise attack like that. In 73, where Egypt and Syria took a stand in an attempt to get their conquered lands back from Israel, had minimal success in doing that and returned away with the inevitable help of the U.S. So indeed, it is often, since 67 anyway, that the United States' support for Israel has made a difference, conceivably prevented the destruction of Israel, but given the military prowess and the cunning and experience of Israel's military leaders, I'd say there's an excellent chance that they're able to withstand the Arabs' armies by themselves. That's my opinion. And I want to finish with the article after I remind you that it is 1600 hours, 4 o'clock p.m. here on the west coast of North America in Santa Cruz County, California. This is the Mideast Madness Show, brought to you every Monday starting at 3 p.m. every Monday on Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting 101.3 FM and streaming live on your computer at www.freakradio, that's F-R-E-A-K, radio.org. Please give to Free Radio so that we may continue to bring you the most alternative of aired programming. It's not like we're on television. Television would be much more expensive, so be grateful that we're, in that sense, running on the cheap to begin with. Please send your donations to FRSC, P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. We thank you so much. Any amount will help, and we do receive hundreds of dollars a month, if not $1,000 every once in a while, from those of you out there who care. Certainly you care to listen. Let's go back to this article. However, this type of frank talk of diverging interests between the United States and Israel will not be among the talking points of the AIPAC Israel First lobbyists on Tuesday, March 5th, last Tuesday. Rather, they will continue to foster the fraudulent notion that the United States will benefit strategically from American taxpayers arming Israel with ever-increasing amounts of weapons to maintain its brutal policies toward Palestinians. More than ever, as the impact of sequestration further devastates the already frayed social safety net in this country, this is an argument that should be rejected on both moral and economic grounds. End of article, appearing in last week's The Hill, in the section The Hill's Congress blog, where lawmakers come to blog. The author, Josh Rubner, is the National Advocacy Director of the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation and author of the forthcoming book, Shattered Hopes, Why Obama Failed to Broker Israeli-Palestinian Peace. That's published by Verso Books, V-E-R-S-O. And a note from The Hill, follow us at The Hill on Twitter, at The Hill on Twitter, or The Hill on Facebook. I have a couple of comments here. Yes, I was aware that Mr. Rubner is a leader of the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. I happen to be a paid member, an annual paying member of that organization. Even the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation is exactly the kind of organization that Zionists and Israelis love to assail for its quote-unquote ties to terrorism. And it's easy for them to make the loosest ties that one could make based on she knows him and he knows them. The Anti-Defamation League, which is a Zionist organization, which exists exclusively for its own sake, with this narrow focus of U.S. support for Israel, the Anti-Defamation League has a long, long list of individuals and organizations that it does exactly this to, makes very generalized, often very generalized, and vague ties to terrorists, to Arab governments, which are known to house terrorist organizations or have in the past. That doesn't mean that, for example, the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation is a terrorist organization. It doesn't mean that they want to exemplify or promote terrorism. They have an agenda which is in the title, U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. And it is indeed, that does translate into the U.S. campaign to end military aid to the Israeli nation. Does this sound so terrible? Is this so frightening? After all, Israel, the modern state of Israel has developed a reputation for mightily defeating its Arab neighbors militarily. And there are a lot of reasons for that. I won't get into them now, but I will say that prior to the massive dollops of U.S. taxpayer-funded aid that they've been receiving in recent decades, they did an excellent job of holding their own, maintaining their own existence at the expense of the Palestinians, I remind you. With the Army, Air Force, Navy, etc., that it has had up until the advent of massive U.S. aid. When the United States or any other rich, great world power steps in to effectively underwrite Israel's security, it is building up an army which was and is designed by its weaponry, by its training, by its tactics and strategy to protect itself against invading armed forces from outside Israel. It is not designed, and it is certainly not ethically or morally excused from suppressing Palestinians. choking the economic and social life out of the Palestinians in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip, which Israel's armies surround and often fire upon indiscriminately. Their armed forces, which you see on TV and in stills, in publications, each soldier is equipped like a U.S. soldier in Afghanistan or the ones we had in Iraq, with their helmets, their body armor, various electronic gadgets attached to their persons. They are designed for a major encounter with another army, a well-equipped army that may have tanks, artillery pieces, and air cover. And here they are suppressing and making life miserable for Palestinians outside the Green Line, which always brings to my attention something that I learned about 20 years ago when we were involved in the United States, was involved in supporting the regimes in El Salvador and the Contras in Nicaragua, Guatemala, that when you have a massive national armed force, which is designed as such as the IDF is designed in order to defend itself from whole armies, and there are no whole armies that have given up attempting to cross their border or never had the intention to do that in the first place, this massive army and all its little toys often, if not inevitably, end up getting pointed to the common citizens of the country to oppress them. Happened in Central America, in South America, parts of Asia and Africa, and even in Israel, this country, which is 27th on the IMF's list of wealthiest nations that has a high standard of living. This country does the same thing to its native Arabs with its designed for offensive capability structure is turned against the lowly rock throwers, often children, who throw rocks at tanks. I guess that's a sequestration, by the way. The article is entitled "Israel Lobby, quote unquote, to push for aid despite sequestration cuts." To remind those of you who may have forgotten, sequestration refers to is a name Washington has for the Something Hollings Act, going back over some 30 years, which was designed as a kind of doomsday machine to prevent recurring funding of U.S. government policies to protect the poor and support and uplift America's poor, disabled, and less fortunate. The word sequestration refers roughly to that law and the set of subsequent laws. That's what sequestration means. Okay. It is time for a break for my tedious voice, and let's have some. I turned it off. Let's have some music from my Arab American collection of music. Let's see now. This one is entitled Number 3. This is Hawil Ya'karam, or Stop and Rest, O Shepherd. As soon as I finish loading it here. Again, music from the Arab American community. This is a retrospective collection.
ونعط على مفون المطرب عامر خداج
حول يا غنام حول بات الليله قول يا غنام بالله شايف حبي وين قول يا غنام بالله شايف حبي وين
حول يا غنام حول بات الليله شفت زين قولي يا غنام بالله شايف حبي وين قولي يا غنام بالله شايف حبي وين ولا عم بشرب بقالي يومين قولي يا غنام بالله شايف حبي وين قولي يا غنام بالله شايف حبي وين
حبيب قلبك في جاه الرحمن تحظي بي ويحظى بك وتعيش بأمان روحي الله يكون معاك بلك تلاقي زين قولي يا غنام بالله شايف حبي وين قولي يا غنام بالله شايف حبي
وين
البر شارد غزالي مين منكم يرضى لي ويريح بالي يا جبال ويا وديان ارتلي حالي يا مناكب يا غدران وين حبي وين قولي يا غنام بالله شايف حبي وين قولي يا غنام بالله شايف حبي وين شايف حبي وين قول لي يا غنام بالله شايف حبي وين.
I want to remind everyone, this is Ren Tawil on the Mideast Madness Show, coming to you via Free Radio Santa Cruz, that most of my programs are archived and available at radioforall.net. That's radio, the number four, the digit, A-L-L, radioforall.net. Just look up Mideast Madness, and you may download any of the shows that I have that have been successfully recorded and archived by me. Some of them also lately have been recorded at Indy Bay Santa Cruz, IndyBay.org. IndyBay.org. So if you've tuned in late or have become aware of this show or something that I've said, some outrageous thing that I may have said during this or any show, you may listen to them at will by way of radioforall.net or Indy Bay .org/Santa Cruz. I think it's just Indy Bay Santa Cruz .org. I also try to rerun my shows on this station, at least going into the wee hours of Tuesday. And lately, with the schedule being in flux, as it often is, I've been able to repeat this very show starting at 6 p.m. So I'll be able, should be able to do that today, and you may listen to my show from 6 to 8. Now, I also wanted to tell everyone that I was hoping to have a guest today, a personal friend of mine who is an Egyptian, served in the Egyptian military. He was a paratrooper. Tried to get in touch with him this weekend. He never returned my call, but I did speak with him some 2 or 3 weeks ago, and he was enthusiastic about appearing on the show, and my friend wants to talk about his life as a Christian in Egypt, in a Muslim environment. If he does, if I manage to get my friend on the show next week, or perhaps after next week, I think people will be quite amazed to hear such a program on this program. So stay tuned. I'm holding in my hot little hand a newspaper clipping. It must be from the Santa Cruz Sentinel, big city newspaper from the big city, of Santa Cruz, California. So, with this token piece of paper, nobody can charge me with only getting my information from the oh-so-insecure, unreliable internet. I'm going to read to you something that I'm actually holding in my hand. It's not a Kindle or a notebook technological notebook. This is a newspaper article entitled Israel, Palestine, and the Oscars by Amy Goodman. It talks about the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences annual awards, namely the Oscar, which, of course, has already been aired a couple of weeks ago. So this article is roughly a month old. The article did come out before the Oscar show. Israel, Palestine, and the Oscars by Amy Goodman. Syndicated through King Features. The Academy Awards ceremony will make history this year with the first ever nomination of a feature documentary made by a Palestinian. Five Broken Cameras was filmed and directed by Ahmad Bernat, a resident of the occupied Palestinian West Bank town of Bilin, along with his Israeli filmmaking partner, Guy Davidi. What does a Palestinian farmer wear on the red carpet in Hollywood? We were almost prevented from knowing as Bernat, his wife, and 8-year-old son were detained at Los Angeles International Airport and threatened with deportation. How many of you knew that? Despite his formal invitation from the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences as an Oscar-nominated filmmaker, it took the intervention of Oscar-winning documentarian Michael Moore, who now sits on the Academy Board of Governors, followed by Academy attorneys, for Bernat and his family to gain entry into the country. Five Broken Cameras is in competition at the Oscars with an Israeli documentary, The Gatekeepers, a film that features interviews with the six surviving former directors of Israel's Shin Bet, the country's secret internal security service, which functions as a sort of hybrid of the U.S. FBI and CIA. In the film, all six... This is the Israeli film she's talking about. All six condemn the current practices of Israeli occupation and settlement expansion. In a remarkable case of life imitating art, as celebrities gather for the entertainment industry's biggest gala of the year, the Israel-Palestine conflict is being played out on the streets of Tinseltown. Hours after regaining his freedom, Bernat issued a statement that read, quote, "Last night on my way from Turkey to Los Angeles, California, my family and I were held at a U.S. immigration, for about an hour and questioned about the purpose of my visit to the United States. Immigration officials asked for proof that I was nominated for an Academy Award for the documentary Five Broken Cameras. And they told me that if I couldn't prove the reason for my visit, my wife, Surya, my son, Gibril, and I would be sent back to Turkey on the same day." End quote. Well, it went on, quote, "After 40 minutes of questions and answers, Gibril, his son, asked me why we were still waiting in that small room. I simply told him the truth. Maybe we'll have to go back. I could see his heart sink." End quote. Gabriel's birth in 2005 was the motivation for the film. Ahmad Bernat got his first camera then to record his fourth son growing up. At that time, the government of Israel began building the separation wall through Bilin, the village of Bilin, provoking a campaign of nonviolent resistance from the Palestinian residents and their supporters. As Bernat recorded the protest, his cameras were smashed or shot one by one, destroyed by the violent response from the Israeli army and the armed Israeli settlers. Dror Morey is the Israeli director of the Gatekeepers. Morey told me, this is Amy Goodman talking now, Morey told me, The settlements are the biggest obstacle to peace. If there is something that will prevent peace, it's the settlements and the settlers. I think this is the largest and most influential and most powerful group in Israeli politics. They're basically dictating the policy of Israel in the last years. I think that definitely for the Palestinians, the settlements are the worst enemy in their way to the homeland. When they see everywhere in Judea and Samaria now, the settlements that are built like mushrooms after rain, they see how their country is shrinking. End quote. That wasn't Amy Goodman talking. That's still a quotation from Dror Murray, the director of the Gatekeepers. And returning to Goodman's article, she says, both Five Broken Cameras and the Gatekeepers are up for the Oscar against other very compelling nominees. How to Survive a Plague about the AIDS epidemic. The Invisible War about rampant, unprosecuted rape in the U.S. military. And Searching for Sugar Man about renewal for a musician long thought dead. Bernat finished his statement on his detention at Los Angeles International Airport. He says, although this was an unpleasant experience, this is a daily occurrence for Palestinians every single day throughout the West Bank. There are more than 500 Israeli checkpoints, roadblocks, and other barriers to movement across our land. And not a single one of us has been spared the experience that my family and I experienced yesterday. Ours was a very minor example of what my people face every day. End quotation. Ms. Goodman winds up her article with, regardless of which documentary wins, the 2013 Oscars mark a historic shift in the public dialogue on Israel/Palestine, a long-overdue shift to which 40 million TV viewers will be exposed. A little credit here. Dennis Moynihan contributed research to this column. Amy Goodman is the host of Democracy Now!, a daily international TV/radio news hour airing on more than 100 stations in North America, including Free Radio Santa Cruz. She is the co-author of The Silenced Majority, a New York Times bestseller. I have comments. Well, wonders never cease. Five Broken Cameras did not garner the Oscar. And as I recall, neither did the Gatekeepers. A third film won out. She didn't even mention the category here. I'm not sure what the category is. Could be best foreign film that the Academy would consider viewing and acknowledging, possibly presenting an award to. I was fortunate enough to see Five Broken Cameras in town here. Only a couple of weeks before the Oscars, I had the privilege and the awesome experience of watching Five Broken Cameras. It was filmed and directed by Emad Bernat, who is a Palestinian resident of Bilin, and he worked alongside Israeli filmmaker Guy Davidi. And this is not the only film, certainly not the only recent film, which Israelis and Palestinians have conspired to produce and release. There really are some excellent things you can get from the video store. I know many of these are available specifically in the Live Oak neighborhood of Eastern Santa Cruz, California at East Cliff Video out on Portola Avenue. East Cliff Video has an excellent collection of Palestinian / Israeli films available for rental. And almost all the ones that I've seen, I've actually gotten via Netflix. Salt of This Earth is one of my favorites. Write that down. Salt of This Earth. Order it on Netflix or try to get it somewhere else. So there, you know, one of the things about Israeli culture and its politics is that there is a great deal of free reign of the local opinion, of the citizens' opinion. There is largely a lot of talk, which is by and large permitted without interference by the government in Israeli society. And the truth is slowly percolating to many Israelis that what they're doing is wrong, that their philosophy is not entirely whole, it doesn't translate into reality. What the Zionist movement, which started up over 100 years ago, promised them does not truly come to fruition the way Herzl and Ben-Gurion and all these, and Jabotinsky portrayed it to be. Israelis are becoming Palestinians in the sense that they are becoming acquainted with what they're doing to the Palestinian Arabs, not only in the territories, but inside Israel itself. There is a notable amount of oppression, economic oppression and persecution, often insidiously symptomatic by Israeli law, of the so-called Israeli Arabs in their own country. Personally, I'm surprised that Burnett didn't take the precautions that would have possibly significantly reduced his 40-minute incarceration and drilling at the airport. The one which was Burnett's family was saved from with the incursion of Michael Moore and attorneys. You know, this is another example, I highly suspect, of how Israel dictates or contributes to the dictation of security policy at our international airports. I'm not saying that Israel or Israeli army people are personally manning the checkpoints there, or the ticket counter, or the security gates, but policy is often effectively mimicked in the U.S. For a long, long time, back in the days before there was a Palestine Authority, or Palestinian Authority, because Israelis don't like the word Palestine. They don't even like the word Palestinian, or Palestinians. There was the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization. Back in the 60s and 70s and into the 80s, certain Americans who may have had contact with the PLO or someone who had contact with the PLO who went to Israel were detained and often jailed. These are American citizens who were virtually summarily, incarcerated because they were considered terrorists, because they had contact with the PLO at one point or another. And that simply could have been, it wasn't necessarily with the Palestine Liberation Organization as such at all. It could have been because they were Arab Americans or friends of Arab Americans who shared their experience and their viewpoint with these Americans. And somehow that got written down and picked up at the Tel Aviv airport, Ben-Gurion airport, other stops in Israel. And Americans were persecuted. Likewise, I feel that there are Israeli security policies that are translated to U.S. policies at our ports of entry and airports. That take the greatest precautions at the great inconvenience of travelers of Arab descent, Arab blood, when they get to the U.S. In a remarkable case of life imitating art, as celebrities gather for the entertainment industry's biggest gala of the year, the Israel-Palestine conflict is being played out on the streets of Tinseltown. It's too bad it's limited to that very kind of broad, generic venue. But at least she points that out, that it's happening in Hollywood. Billing drawer. Yeah, the gatekeepers. I have seen five broken cameras. I have not seen the gatekeepers. I don't know if I will have a chance to. I did read from one Israeli activist in sympathy with the Palestinians. His name is Miko Peled, the son of famous Israeli army general Mati Peled, the late Mati Peled. Miko sent a single paragraph dispatch around to his people on his list saying that there was a lot about the gatekeepers that he did not like. It actually had a tendency to justify what Israel does when it didn't need to do that. And he ends his little paragraph, Miko does, with the sentence, "They make me sick." So I don't even know if I want to see the gatekeepers. But it's available out there. There are more than 500 Israeli checkpoints, roadblocks, and other barriers to movement across our land, and not a single one of us has been spared the experience that my family and I experienced yesterday at the airport. Ours was a very minor example of what my people face every day. Occasionally you will find truthful, candid statements like that in American media. And that's my comment, my commentary on the article, Israel, Palestine, and the Oscars, editorial by Amy Goodman through King Features, assisted by Dennis Moynihan. Amy Goodman has done a spot for us about 10 seconds that I've heard once on this station. It's 4:41 p.m., 1641 hours. On the west coast of California. As a weekly habit, I remind everyone of the boycott against SodaStream. SodaStream is made in illegal Israeli settlements. It is a kitchen device for carbonating tap water. SodaStream is made in the West Bank Mishor Edomim Industrial Park in the Ma'ale Adumim settlements, as I've said over and over again, are illegal under international law, which Israel ignores, putting precedence onto the political aim of Zionism to repopulate the land for Jews only. That's what Zionism is. So the settlements are illegal according to the United Nations and the Geneva Fourth Convention. Sometimes the ones that I've seen in town here say made in Poland. I think some say made in China. They may be referring to the packaging for all I know. But I do know that some of the SodaStream product is printed on the product or the container made in Israel, which, of course, is a lie. It is incorrect. It's not made in Israel. It's made on Palestinian land, where Israelis are not supposed to be. There are Palestinian workers in the factory who are overworked and underpaid, I've been told. Other than that, Palestinians do not receive any profits from the profits of SodaStream, Avaaz Beauty Products, and other products that are available in this country, in the U.S. You see, products made in Israeli West Bank settlements use illegally seized Palestinian land, water, and minerals. Exploitation of natural resources in any occupied territories around the world is not allowed by international law. The international boycott of firms that supported apartheid in South Africa helped overturn that racist regime. We can do it again. And yes, folks, Zionism and the Israeli state are racist entities. So often we hear the drumbeat of anti-Semitism. People who criticize us are just anti-Semites. They hate Jews. Israel is a racist entity which oppresses Semites who call themselves Arabs. Some argue that the word Semitic refers not to a people but to a language or a group of languages, such as Hebrew, the language of the Jews, of the ancient Hebrews, actually, or Arabic, spoken across northern Africa and southwestern Asia, Aramaic, Berber. Other languages are all Semitic languages. But don't be fooled by the overuse of the term anti-Semitism as it applies to Jews. Israel commits constantly, countless times, terrible instances of anti-Semitism against Arab Semites who are not Jewish. Wear that one for a while. I'd love to talk about this stuff with you folks. Let's see here. I'm going to refresh the Shoutcast DNAS status. We can see how many people are listening to us on the air. Oh, it's one less than before. Somebody hung up. Well, who knows where they went to. How sad. But it's good to know that some people are listening. Here's an oft-quoted from this program quotation, a couple of quotations from Ariel Sharon. I think it is very much tied to many of the things that I've talked about today. On an information card, there is the now renowned series of four maps of Palestine, which progressively more and more of which becomes Israel, showing Palestinian loss of land from 1946 to the present. It's too bad you can't see it. In that respect, it's too bad we're not on TV. But keep an eye. This map has appeared on the sides of buses and other transit in San Francisco and perhaps other cities. On the back side of this card, it says, fragmentation of land on the West Bank blocks the creation of a viable Palestinian state. In 1998, Ariel Sharon infamously said, and I remember this being an item in the news, quote, everybody has to move, run, and grab as many hilltops as they can. Everything we don't grab will go to them, end quote. This was at a time when an agreement of sorts was carved out between Palestinians and Israelis to reduce the number of Jewish settlements, which happened negligibly. Only a few token number of Israeli outposts and settlements were either reduced in size or eliminated. And it was during this time, which was meant to provide justice for both sides, and entirely in the spirit of peace and mutual security, that Sharon, who I think in 1998 was the prime minister or would become the prime minister, says everybody has to move, run, and grab as many hilltops as they can. Everything we don't grab will go to them. He was referring, of course, in the first part of the quotation, to his fellow Jews and settlers who, by a certain deadline, needed to claim as much of the influx West Bank as they possibly could. And in the latter half of the quotation, everything we don't grab will go to them, them meaning the native Palestinians. But here's the real shocker to me. Back in 1973, Ariel Sharon was reported to have said this to Winston Churchill III. I don't know the circumstances. I don't know if he was being interviewed by Churchill III or if it was just a side comments, but it was recorded and goes as such. Quote, this is Ariel Sharon talking. Quote, we'll make a pastrami sandwich of them. We'll insert a strip of Jewish settlement in between the Palestinians and then another strip of Jewish settlement right across the West Bank so that in 25 years' time, neither the United Nations nor the United States, nobody will be able to tear it apart, end quote. Ariel Sharon, this was back in 73. 1973, fast forward to the current state of affairs, or well before that, just fast forward 10 or 20 years from 73, you saw the makings of this quotation, of this Sharon quotation coming to life, coming to fruition. And that's exactly what has happened, folks. The Israelis do not merely maintain over 500 checkpoints and block and roadblocks and have a deathful, frightening presence with tanks and all these soldiers and occasionally jet planes which deliberately break the sound barrier much closer to the ground than what we're used to in this country when a jet breaks the sound barrier, which frightens and delivers physical stress, particularly to children. Not only do they maintain this presence in Palestine, but they also barricade the country from Jordan, with the army stationed at all the bridges over the River Jordan, all the connections, the access points to the country of Jordan, and at various other border areas bordering the Israeli state. They do not merely surround the Palestinians, but they, like Sharon was saying to Winston Churchill III, they're so intrinsically entrenched in the territories in a manner that cuts off, with great help from their so-called security wall, one Palestinian town from another, village from another, one community from another. The wall itself physically even separates, it runs across the land in the possession of Palestinian farmers, often separating them in their homes from their fields. It's everywhere. It's an octopus. Okay. It's 4:52 p.m. Once again, please send your donations. If you are indeed listening, and perhaps as despondent as I am over the fact that I don't get calls, I don't get much of an indication. Well, I do occasionally get phone calls, sometimes from another collective member, but on a few occasions from people who are listening to the show, but because I don't get them as often as I can, I am in despondence, and you may feel that, you may empathize with me. Do not throw away this radio service, this program in particular. Please send your contributions to Free Radio Santa Cruz. That's, put on your envelopes there, FRSC, P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz. That's two words, S-A-N-T-A, second word, C-R-U-Z, in California. Just write capital C, capital A, zip code 95061. The material I have on Zev Jabotinsky, The Iron Wall from the South African Jewish Herald, 26 November 1937. I've been dying to get to that for a long time. I can't seem to fit it in. But what will take precedence are your phone calls, to a certain point anyway. If you call in, it might not be that people don't listen to the show. People may be shy. They may be more interested in hearing my opinion and possibly in getting facts and information from this source. I don't think you'll find too many exclusively Palestinian American, or certainly not very many exclusively Palestinian viewpoints through U.S. mainstream media. This is one of them. Yes, I do read back to you material that I come across. I am not a great researcher, but I personally have great faith in the sources from which I get this stuff. Archive of most of my shows available on radioforall.net or indiebaysantacruz.org. This is Mideast Madness. Ren Tawil speaking. And I'll talk at you a week from now, next Monday at 3 p.m. Maybe I'll have my buddy to interview, the Egyptian Christian. Thanks for listening.